Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve is in conversation with Aaron Painter. Aaron is the founder and CEO of NameTag, a company whose mission is to enable people to build more trusted relationships by preventing identity fraud. In 2017, Aaron wrote a best-selling book titled Loyal, based on his experience living and working in 6 countries across 4 continents. In Loyal, he describes his key to leadership, fostering a culture of listening. Today, he and Steve discuss how he came to write Loyal and how his advice for workplace leaders has evolved since starting a company in the midst of the pandemic.
Aaron, what I wanted to talk to you about today is over the last, few days anyway, more and more people have been talking to me about the challenge they face with workplace culture and how do they deal with some of those issues around people working, you know, remotely versus in an office, the hybrid solution, what people are now expecting to get from a workplace environment. So I thought it would be quite interesting for us to start the conversation by almost sort of stepping back in time to 2017 and looking at some of the themes that you explored in your book, Loyal, at that time, and then sort of fast forwarding it to 22 to see how things had changed. And really also getting into, after that, issues around trust and finally ending up with some of the technology around that. Is that going to work for you?
Definitely. I think that can be fun. And if you feel like that's something you're picking up sort of narrative-wise in society, let's run with it.
Great. It comes down to a few conversations I've been having recently with chief executives of organizations that are sort of outside of the security space, but are sort of saying, look, what are you seeing? How do you deal with some of the challenges of the new work environment? And what is it that our teams can be doing to really, I suppose, help our staff be true to themselves, be present, and therefore deliver customer excellence in terms of the experience? And if I remember correctly, looking back to Loyal, which, as I said earlier, was published back in the summer of 2017, you explore in that some of those themes about how companies had to adapt to evolving expectations, engage better with employees. And I think there's a couple of statements in there around the fact that, you know, successful business leaders create this culture of listening to inspire loyalty and build a competitive advantage. So what were some of those themes that you were exploring at that point in time?
In 2017, I was living in China. And it was certainly a different landscape than we live in today of both how the US and China viewed the world and how we all live and work in a virtual sense. But I had spent at that point, the preceding 15 years of my career going somewhere new, and I was truly an outsider. I arrived and I often didn't look or sound like anyone else at the table. And yet I was expected to sort of perform in a business context. And the employees that I would sort of be in a geography to work with and theory to manage often saw me as an outsider. They saw me as, you know, being sent from maybe headquarters or certainly culturally an outsider and not someone that they knew had expectations around or frankly that they felt like they could trust. And I, on the other side, often didn't speak the language. And I was in a place, let's say in 2017, it was Beijing. And I had to find a way sort of to be successful and to fit in. And so given that divide, listening to me, to your point, I referenced many times in my book, was sort of the gateway to helping others feel respected. And then ultimately, when someone feels respected, I believe that's a pathway for building trust.
And what were some of the sort of tips that you outlined at that time that business leaders could perhaps follow or try out to try to improve some of the challenges they were facing?
For me, one of the most interesting periods was when I first moved to Hong Kong. And you think, Hong Kong, at least they sort of speak English there. And it turned out working in my industry and technology, the ecosystem was actually quite local. It turned out the sort of English speakers were often people maybe working in finance, and the people working in tech had been quite local. Cantonese was maybe their native language. And when I came at first, the team that I was sort of set to manage, our Microsoft team in Hong Kong, felt like things were going well. I said, you know what, don't come disrupt things. We're happy here. You don't come bring a lot of outside energy, so to speak. Things are very consistent. We know how things are done. And yet our business results at the time didn't say that. Our business results said things could be a lot better. And so when I first started, I sat literally in a room with people and I said, hey, we're going to start to have one-on-ones. I'd love to hear from you how you think the business is going and maybe things that you think could be better. I went on sort of what I now think of as a listening tour, as one sort of piece of advice I often give. And I went on this listening tour and asked a lot of the folks then, what could be better? What ideas do you have? And they were stunned at first. They said, well, we're here for you to tell us what to do. I said, well, I'd love to hear from you first. And just sitting back and listening and allowing others to share their thoughts and ideas turned out to be great insights that allowed me to then put together a plan based on other people's ideas, because they knew the market best, of things that could be different. It turned out then that some people were in the right roles, others were not. They might have been very talented, but they might not have been placed in a role that could take advantage of their talents. And I was able to get a sense of that from some of the conversations. I was also then able to get a sense for where there could be different personalities or different skills that we might bring to the team. So it let me go shape what open roles and a kind of a hiring plan should look like. But most importantly, the people that I was working with and managing started to feel a sense that I respected their opinion. The next thing I did, I would try. I said, you know what? I'm not going to sit in an office and close myself up in a kind of my own room. They didn't like that. Culturally, they still said, hey, give it some space. We think, you know, you should sit in your own office, but you can leave your door open. But I was trying to send that message as many ways as I can, that others' opinions mattered and that I didn't come with all the answers, but I came with enough questions and enough respect of the local team to try and learn from them and combine it with practices maybe that I knew were working well for us in other markets. And that formed the basis of a successful sort of business turnaround plan at that point. And people started bringing energy to it. The energy started to grow because people felt like I respected them such that they could maybe have an idea that wouldn't work and I still might be open to it. And that began to create a sense of trust across the team. And ultimately, that became a core part of our cultural tenet and really something that took that business from one that wasn't successful to one that was wildly successful.
You mentioned a really important word there, which is trust. Where do you think we are today in the business world when it comes to trust? It's a very sort of broad-based question, I know. But a lot of people that I talk to today, both who are in senior leadership roles and otherwise, do say to me that they're struggling with trying to preserve this trust dynamic because they don't see their people as often, the teams don't get together as often, all of those sorts of things are going on. So what's your insight there?
I think we're at a horrible trust deficit in society right now. And like most business leaders, I see it often in two fronts. I see it one with people and employees, and I see it two with customers. I'll leave out the concept of trust deficit maybe with government and politicians and political leaders. Part of the premise I had in my book is that when you create a culture where employees feel heard and where they feel trusted, they carry that out to how they engage with customers. For me, I sat on the call centers of a really modern kind of direct-to-consumer brand in the U.S., and I watched how curious those employees were to hear customer feedback, to hear customer comments, good, bad, otherwise. But then I also saw on the other side how the culture inside that company, those employees were eager to hear from their customers because they knew that their managers were eager to hear from them. And so, oh, I got this customer insight. Let me go to share it with my colleagues. Let me go share it with my manager. And they knew that opinion mattered. And that's partly where I saw more and more of this circle where when employees feel that sense of connection and trust, they're going to carry that out to how that company interacts with its customers. But on trust more broadly, I worry that in a virtual sense, in a remote world of work, it is difficult for employers and employees to build that trust and get to know each other. In fact, when I started my current company 2.5 years ago, we were in the middle of the pandemic. I thought it would be an all-in-person operation. We went, got some great office space in Seattle and we're all set. And then the talents I started finding and really wanted to work with were all over the place. And they certainly weren't coming to the office, let alone getting on a plane and coming to Seattle or moving to Seattle at that time. And I said, gosh, I know I can continue a trusted relationship online, but can I fundamentally build new ones? That was a big open question for me. And we had to be very creative in the type of things we deployed in our workplace. And we can talk more about that. But to try and create that sense of trust for people that didn't know each other, if we were going to be successful professionally and in kind of our business goal. I worry that that is harder for organizations that are larger and at scale already today. And particularly if you think of it with a little bit of a security lens. the amount of kind of workplace fraud we are seeing from employers that are hiring people. They show up for a Zoom interview and their camera's off, and the employer's not exactly sure who they hired. You know, in the US, the process of verifying someone's ability to work, their I-9 status, happens several days after they start. And we've had these incidences where employees are hired and they get an offer letter, they show up for work, and day one, they're downloading a whole bunch of IP from the corporate network and disappear. Mm-hmm. Or they've been hired for a role and they have cleverly, I guess you can suggest, outsourced their work.
Right.
And they found other people that they have hired who they think could be equally talented to go do their job. We had one company tell us that they were actually impressed with the people that their fake employee outsourced to, but that those people didn't have the necessary certifications and other things to do the job because they had promised their client a certain level of standards and otherwise in the people that they hire. And this world of not being able to see someone makes it very difficult to trust who is behind the screen. And that relationship between an employer and employee is so core, especially if it's new and is starting only virtually. To build that sense of trust, I think, is incredibly hard.
So tell us how you went about doing that. I'm really interested in that because, as I say, you know, if I just look at my own organization, we're in a fortunate position of having worked with a lot of the same people in one office location, but we have people all around the world. And the issue that you raise there about how do you know who you're hiring effectively is certainly one, I think, that concerns pretty much anybody today who's operating across a number of different locations, right? So how did you go about fixing this trust problem, if I could put it that way, when you started your company?
Yeah, we've tampered with the experience quite a bit. Part of it is we rely heavily on video.
Right.
We rely heavily on a sense of clarity. Practically, it's video. Practically, it's messaging tools, Slack and Teams and other things to allow a conversation to be going a lot. We jump into huddles. You know, let's quickly just chat about something rather than type endlessly about it if we feel like we're at a stuck point. But culturally, it's a bit more than that. Culturally, we try and hire folks that have a high sense of integrity, that have a sense of energy, and where we feel like they have a track record of having delivered results kind of in an independent way or doing well with sort of empowerment. And so the three things that I ground a lot on today are we clear on what someone should be doing? Are they empowered? Or do they feel like they can do the work independently? And is there accountability for have they done the work well or delivered what they promised, let's say their colleagues, through the team? And I try and combine those three things because I can't watch. I'm not going to know if someone showed up, you know, whatever time they logged in that day. Maybe a status light turns green, but that's not really a fair way to measure someone. That certainly doesn't make someone feel like you trust them to do their best work. And so we try and be clear on what the goals are. We give them that sense of empowerment to go solve it the best way they think they can. And then a sense of accountability. Very practically, on Monday, everyone says what they're going to do. On Friday, we check in and say, hey, did everyone do it? And throughout each day, we have sort of daily stand-ups, particularly on the engineering side, where everyone runs through, hey, here are the things I'm going to try and get done today. I might need your help, or I might need your help. Or someone chimes in, ah, you have a dependency with me. Let's make sure we have a separate chat about that. But at the end of the week, people hopefully partition their time in the right way. If they wanted to take a nap in the middle of the day or go out and walk their dog or meet their child for this or exercise, great. But they have a sense of accountability for what they need to deliver in that week. And we trust them to allocate their personal time around their work commitments. And then they hold each other accountable. Hey, you said you were going to get these things done. Oh, great. I did. Oh, this thing came up. I wasn't able to. Let me make sure I get to it over the weekend or on Monday. Right. Again, it's that sense of trust that people can create their own schedule as long as they deliver results and are accountable to each other on what they say they'll get done.
I think that inter-team accountability is a really important point because that certainly takes the onus away from this very outdated, in my opinion, sort of hierarchical approach that, you know, whether you've got a manager sitting there watching what's going on and perhaps people, you know, may not have established how well they were doing until they came to their sort of annual appraisal and all of that kind of thing. So what I'm hearing you say is that you've really instituted a much more dynamic, in the moment, self-leveling kind of organization where people feel able to raise issues that perhaps they're struggling with, but are accountable to other members of their team for actually getting the job done. Now, if I think about that within the context of, say, a large corporation, I'm sure there'll be people listening to this thinking, either that's great, I'd love to be able to do it, but how on earth do I get started? Or that simply doesn't fit with our culture. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's where some of the challenges now lie in terms of, you know, a post-COVID work environment, because whether we like it or not, COVID brought about so many changes. The pandemic changed the world of work forever, in my view. So what kind of advice would you give to people listening to this in a large corporation, you know, sitting there thinking, yep, like the sound of that, how do I get started?
In some ways, it becomes very practical. I would say, think about what is it that you as, a, say, a team manager or a team leader are trying to accomplish, let alone as CEO at an organizational level. Getting clear on goals. You need to huddle with your leadership team, and whether it's on an annual, a quarterly, a monthly basis, almost doesn't matter. But hopefully you can get to some sense of what clarity looks like for business goals. And people need that. Employees, anyone on a team that's going to march towards a goal need to know what the goals are in order to make sure that they can meet them, let alone exceed them. So to step back and try and ensure that you have some sense of clarity in your own mind, sometimes you don't. And that's actually a very healthy exercise. But then you can take those set of goals and communicate them with the team. If you need to cascade them, if you need to say, this person's a partner, you know, my goal has 10 components, each team has one subcomponent. That's a normal exercise in cascading those. Google, as you know, has been very common in this. In fact, has even tried some slightly different approaches in landing what they call OKRs, or accountability metrics, at quite a large scale across their organization. But they follow the same practice. Be clear in what someone needs to accomplish so that someone can actually meet those expectations. The other piece, I'll sidetrack a little bit, but people often say, my employees are leaving, how do I keep them? Mm-hmm. And one of the things I talk about in my book is a model I call STAY. It's an acronym, STAY. And I think of the first one as salary and compensation, and you need to pay someone well and to market. There's an element of training, you know, does someone know how to do the job, or are they getting access to the learning and development opportunities they need? There's alignment, which is alignment between often the company's mission and what it does, as much as someone's personal mission and maybe what they want to do in their life. But the why is different, because so often when I talk about the STAY model with a manager, they say, the first, I can outsource those. HR needs to figure that out. They need to make sure we're paying fairly and that there's learning and development and, you know, roughly that we hired well. The why is you as a manager engaging, being there, being present, asking the questions, helping to, often I say a one-on-one is about importing anxiety and exporting energy, right? Being there and having conversations with your employees. And so once you have clarity in what those goals are, I believe a lot of it does come down to those frontline managers being the ones that are there, making sure the employees understand it, answering questions on it, giving feedback, refining, and being the ones that are providing the level of engagement that an employee needs.
So some good tips there, some good insight into how to adapt, I guess, to a new working environment. Let me just shift a little bit now, because you mentioned something else slightly earlier where you were talking about the difficulty of, in the hiring process, knowing that the person on the other end of the camera effectively was actually who was going to turn up for work. And that's one aspect of the challenge that organizations face. That becomes even more, I think, exacerbated and more difficult to handle when we start to consider things like insider threat from a security standpoint. But one of the things that I did want to talk to you about was your new company, the one that you set up a couple of years ago now, as you said earlier that you'd started it, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic. What were the sorts of things that you were trying to address when you did that? Because I was interested to read that some of the drivers were things like identity theft. Some, you know, family members and that kind of thing who'd really got themselves all caught up in some of the things that we know happen and hope never will to ourselves and friends and family. So talk to us a little bit about the driver behind setting up this new company, which is called NameTag.
Yeah, to me, it really came back to that point you had on trust and feeling like trust in society is at an all-time low. And frankly, that it's simply too hard to trust the identity of someone on the phone or online. And so, as you mentioned, you're right, it was very personal for me. At the start of the pandemic, I had several friends and family members who had their identity stolen. And I said, I'm going to be a good friend. I'm going to be a good son. Let's jump on the phone. Let's call, you know, call these companies. Let's try and get things sorted out. And everyone we called had these series of bizarre questions. You might think of knowledge-based security questions to authenticate if it was really my friend or family member calling. Right. And some of them were too easy, you know, what's your favorite color? And some of them were too hard, what street did you live in 19 this? And they either couldn't get them right, they were right. No matter what, it led to frustration. And frankly, we got off the phone saying, no wonder the identity was stolen. Like, this is how accounts are protected. this simply isn't sufficient. And I had a lot of empathy for the poor call center rep on the other side who was trying to do their job, who got into the business in theory because they like helping people. And instead of being able to help, they have to be an identity detective at the start of every call to interrogate the poor caller who's unhappy and frustrated to begin with, right? With on who are you really? And as we realized and looked into it more, it's not much better online, right? You have a username and a password today. Fortunately, passwords are often easily compromised or shared. And you try and make it more secure with, you know, SMS verification or an authenticator app. And in some cases, those work. In other cases, they create other problems because people get locked out. They've got a new phone. They lost their phone. My authenticator app didn't work. I didn't know how to set it up. And you know what? You end up back on the phone with that trusty customer support representative who is the one to unlock things or to let you back in and back to kind of that lowest line of defense on security questions. And so it was this hypothesis that really it is just too hard to trust someone on the other end of the screen. And to your point, when you get to employee scenarios, gosh, if someone calls and says they're an employee locked out of their account, it's that poor IT help desk rep who's trying to say, all right, let me see, do I let you back in? And that does create an enormous set of risk and vulnerability. And then it's even worse on the customer side. Mm-hmm. And actually, we started out building something for the customer side. I think we've been surprised at how many companies say, actually, we have this problem on the employee side as well, with IT help desk, with hiring, things like that. But on the customer side, you know, think of all the services that we have that are governed only by digital access to those accounts. Accounts we might care about. Of course, it might be a financial account. You know, if you're a social media person, it might be your social media account. If you're a gamer, it might be your digital gaming account. Accounts that we care about that often have this very low-hanging fruit of how they are protected, with access to calling a customer support rep or having your sort of account password reset or your access reset. So that was the problem we sort of set out to solve. And there are basic ones there, and then there are even more exciting chapters when you think about trust in society just lacking, like dating sites. Like, oh my goodness, the fact that you are building a virtual relationship with someone, getting to know, you might then go meet them in person if all goes well, and you really only know them by an email address.
Right.
Like, you actually don't know who's behind that dating account, or the caretaker or babysitter that you hire on a caretaking platform, or the person who's renting your Airbnb or your house or your apartment. You know them really only by an email address, not authentically who they are as a person. And that's the bridge we tried to create, and having a solution that allows companies to validate the identity of a person, not simply the phone number they have or their email address or the device they're holding.
Right. So a clear articulation there of the problem. So what does the solution look like?
We bridge someone's government-issued ID and selfie, the selfie photo of them, to make sure it matches that government-issued ID to assess, is this really the person? And so you can imagine going to a website that you want premium protection on or that you care about, and you would click a sign-in button just like normal. And if it was on a desktop, maybe you scan a QR code to make it extra modern. If you're on your phone, you just tap that button. And something essentially pops up on your phone. Technically, it's what we call an app clip. Or Apple calls an app clip with the technology they released in 2019, something similar on Android. Mm-hmm. It's a super cool technology where it's essentially an app from the App Store delivered over the air without the end user having to go to the App Store and download it. This was a big innovation. Very few companies are using it, but it's super slick and modern. Essentially, it allows us to put this security mini app, as I often call it, on your device that can guide you through a quick process of, hey, in order to access this site, they need to know who you are. Please scan your government-issued ID. Please take a selfie. Great, these things match up behind the scenes. And then we offer a very explicit line of consent where, hey, this company is asking for, let's say, only your legal name, or only, let's say, that you're over age 18. Even though you scanned your government-issued ID, maybe your driver's license, your passport, you don't need to share all of that information necessarily with the company that's asking for it. So you review what they're asking for, and if you're good, you click share, or you click log in or sign in or whatever the button says, and you're in to the website. The other really neat thing about these app clips is that the next time you come back to access that site, whether it's the same site or another site that's using our service, you don't have to scan your government-issued ID again. That is stored, that binding, as we call it, is securely stored inside the enclave of the phone. And so the next time you come back, you might just use Face ID, or you might take a selfie if it was a high security transaction. You click sign in, and you're in even more express. But in all those cases, you have strong confidence that only the person who you intended to access that account is the one accessing that account, not whoever might happen to have the, let's say, the username and the password. We say we verify people instead of those passwords or devices.
Which is interesting because what that does, and correct me if I've got this wrong, but what that seems to me to do is it hands control back to the person, because as you say, I now am determining how the process is going to unfold, whereas that doesn't always seem to be the case when we look at it from some of the traditional ways of doing it. For those listening to this who are perhaps in Europe and where, you know, GDPR is certainly at the top of most people's minds in terms of the information that they share and all of the privacy regulations, it seems to be able to control some of that regulatory exposure because you're not sharing everything that is out there. And then the third thing, which I guess is probably top of mind for most people, is it does help you to really thwart, to an extent, the fraudster. Because again, of this control, because it's a photo-based identity system, which at the back end is checking through all of the data. Have I got that right? Is that the sort of thing that that we're talking about here?
You've got it spot on. And from a GDPR perspective, you know, we've tried to be overly progressive in some ways. We have lawyers that review our things and say, wow, this is sort of the role model implementation, because at the same time, the user has the ability to revoke what they share and kind of opt out themselves.
Right.
We are fully a user, we only share when a user consents. So there's not necessarily a need to opt out because you have to proactively opt in order to share. We've done some other really cool things on the back end where a company doesn't actually have to even store the data that they might ask for. So they can simply have a placeholder sort of to access it and use it as they need if the user has given consent. But the other neat scenarios that pop up, I get excited about, are things like age verification. If you think of the UK online safety bill and the discussions around that, right, or similar legislation that's sort of winding its way through both federally and in California and the US, there are other needs to help keep the internet safe. Mm-hmm. Some of that is age, some of that is avoiding fraudsters. One of the neat things also is every person only gets one name tag.
Right.
And so we have this ability that it's recoverable. If you've got a new phone and you want to have your expressibility on that new phone, it's a simple handoff process. But unlike an email address where if you want to be someone different or you're a bad actor, you can just go create another Gmail address, you can't do that with name tag. It helps prevent fraudsters from getting onto the platform in the first place, which we believe help lead to a safer internet.
Fantastic. Aaron, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you latterly about the technology, but much more broadly about trust issues and how we can perhaps adapt better to work in an environment that has certainly changed from what most people remember it, but I think is really only going to continue to evolve, and certainly some very useful tips and hints there as to how we might all deal with that ever-changing landscape. So thank you very much indeed for taking the time today. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And I'm sure that our listeners will have gone away with some useful food for thought there. So thank you very much.
A pleasure. I'm a big fan of the podcast, Stephen. Thank you for having me on.
We'll be back with a new episode in a week. In the meantime, as always, we ask that you take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening and give us a 5-star rating. If you have a little more time, you can even write a quick review. That helps other listeners who might enjoy our content find us. And we also want to make sure to introduce you to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or a question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org. Which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Thanks for listening.